I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. You're going to become familiar with the name Obergefell as a result of oral arguments today before the U.S. Supreme Court. Jim Obergefell from Ohio sued for the right to be listed on his husband's death certificate after they were married in another state. Ohio officials denied his request. Obergefell v. Hodges involves this case and three other cases of couples from three other states, Kentucky, Michigan, and Tennessee. At issue is whether state bans on same-sex marriage are constitutional, or, put another way, whether same-sex marriage is a constitutional right. It's an important, even historic case involving states' rights, due process, equal protection, procreation, and precedent. Today in Radio Times, we get a preview of the arguments and analysis from two legal scholars who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. John Culhane is a professor of law, co-director of the Family Health Law and Policy Institute at Widener Law, Delaware, co-author of a book called Same-Sex Legal Kit for Dummies. He's also a contributor to Slate Magazine. John Culhane, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Always good to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And also with us is Jeffrey Rosen, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, which is right across the street from WHYY. He's a law professor at George Washington University, a contributing editor for Atlantic Magazine, the author of several books, including most recently Constitution 3.0, Freedom and Technological Change. And Jeffrey Rosen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be back.
Jeffrey, let me begin with you, but John, I want to have you weigh in as well. In preparation for this interview, I read a lot about this case. Some have said this is the most important case a Supreme Court has ever heard in the history of this country. Some have put it on the same wavelength, I guess, as Loving or Brown versus the Board. I mean, how should we, Jeffrey, think about this case?
Well, I think it's fair to say that this is the most important civil rights issue of our time, the most important undecided question about whether equality of marriage will be extended to gays and lesbians. So the analogy to Loving versus Virginia, which struck down anti-miscegenation laws, or to Brown versus Board of Education, which struck down separate but equal schools, seems appropriate. And if the Supreme Court does hold either that marriage is a fundamental right that has to be available to everyone on equal terms, or that bans on same-sex marriage violate the Equal Protection Clause and are infected by animus, that will certainly be viewed for our time as a decision on par with, in its significance, Brown versus Board of Education.
For you, John, how important is this case?
I agree with that. And I guess I would add that, you know, it's interesting because a generation ago, nobody was thinking, or very few people were thinking, of marriage as the defining issue in what's now called the LGBT rights movement. But it's really very it's an important point in the sense that it's the one place or one of the few places where the state really is the one that's fencing out the same-sex couples. So you have a situation where you're picking the one issue or one of the two issues, military being the other, right, where the state was deciding, right, who gets to be married and who doesn't in a way that fenced out an entire part of the population. So I think it's very important from that perspective.
Well, and even Jeffrey picking up on that, it is, I mean, it's been called states' rights, but it's also about, do voters in a state have the right to ban same-sex marriage in that state? And the four states that we're talking about, voters did.
It's a crucial question. That question was central to the majority opinion that's being reviewed here by Judge Jeffrey Sutton. He said we should have enough respect for democracy not to assume that voters are prejudiced and are infected by animus, that basically restoring tradition or traditional moral values is a legitimate basis for voters to resist same-sex marriage. Chief Justice John Roberts, in his dissenting opinion from the opinion last year striking that down the Defense of Marriage Act, also said, I wouldn't be so quick to tar the voters with animus. And there are some really interesting briefs in this case filed by religious organizations saying, if you're going to say that our traditional beliefs are a form of prejudice, you're reading us out of the American conversation. Now, the argument on the other side, though, is that a bunch of Supreme Court cases have said, first of all, that the desire to preserve tradition for its own sake is not a legitimate reason for maintaining the status quo, and also that moral disapproval of a particular practice is not a legitimate reason. So as long as those two precedents are on the books, it's going to be hard for justices to conclude that these initiatives are not infected by animus because of the way that the court has defined it. But that's the central question. Is it judges or voters who decide? Just one more quick point,
sure,
which is that If I've got these numbers right, the three of us were discussing right before, it seems like 37 states now allow same-sex marriage, but many of those were ordered to do so by judicial opinions. If you just count the numbers where voters chose to embrace same-sex marriage, it's more like 12 states. So this is a case where the reform has been driven by judges, and that makes all the more important the question of who decides, judges or voters.
You want to wait on that?
I do. So I think animus is really sort of at the base of this, or one possible base of this. And that's because Justice Kennedy, in his decisions on gay rights, and he's been the author of the three major gay rights decisions, is really very concerned about this. And in the Windsor case, when he talks about the Defense of Marriage Act. The Defense of Marriage Act case in 2013, what he says there is the whole reason – basically, this is what he says, that the reason the Defense of Marriage Act was passed was because of animus toward gay and lesbian people. And, you know, Justice Scalia in a dissent says, well, no, there are plenty of good reasons why you would pass a law like this, right? Because it's confusing if different states have different rules. You want some federal uniformity. But for Justice Kennedy, once he found that the law had an improper motivation, that was kind of the end of the analysis, as far as I could tell. And in cases like this, where it's complicated, right? So animus, you know, the definition of that is not as clear as we think it is. Does it mean fear? Does it mean a dislike? Right? It's kind of a complicated word. If you look at some of these laws, like in Ohio, the constitutional amendment there, it doesn't just rule out marriage, right? It says not only the state, but its subdivisions, right? Cities, towns, counties can't have anything even that looks like marriage. So if you look at laws like that, they start to look a little bit more like they're infected by something besides just marriage protection.
Well, and even going back to the Loving decision, and this goes back a number of decades, and this was a decision that struck down bans on interracial marriage. Jeffrey, this was the court intervening on states and miscegenation laws.
It was, and the analogy is really interesting. So in Loving, what Chief Justice Warren said essentially is these laws are formally neutral. African Americans can't marry whites and whites can't marry African Americans. But everyone knows what the real purpose of these laws are. It is to stigmatize and degrade African Americans, and it's based on the presumption of their inferiority that they're not good enough to marry white people. The question in this case is, are laws that try to preserve traditional marriage also based on a premise of stigmatizing and degrading, or is preserving traditional marriage on its own sake permissible without being prejudiced against gay people? The analogy is also complicated by this fact. Here, men can't marry women and women can't marry men. It's formally neutral. In order to say that it's sex discrimination, you have to argue, as Andrew Koppelman has in one of his briefs, that really the intent is to preserve traditional gender roles, to prevent men from behaving like women and women like men, and that is sort of infected by animus in the way the Loving case was. That's a slightly more complicated argument than the case of anti-miscegenation, where, again, it was obvious what the purpose of those laws were, and that's what makes this a little bit trickier.
You know, what's interesting about the four cases, not the Obergefell case, but the three other cases involve couples that have children. And
right.
How much, you know, does that change either constitutional arguments, legal arguments, public opinion?
Right. So I could start this by saying that if you look at the briefs that are filed by the attorneys for the couples, right, and then you look at the briefs filed by the state, you'll see sort of two very different things. So in the couples' brief, you see kind of a rich description of their lives. In the state's briefs and in the Sixth Circuit opinion, you see just enough information about the couples to decide the case. And I think that's because, you know, everybody acknowledges that there are real costs to real people in these marriage laws. And the attempt is to talk about, you know, sort of greater principles of what marriage means and, you know, sort of historical definitions. But if you look at what people need, then it sort of changes. The Ohio case, or one of the Ohio cases, is interesting because there you had a couple that had married in New York, was living in New York, went to Ohio to adopt a child because that's where the child was, right? And then couldn't get both of their names on the birth certificate. So even though they're living in New York, right, that recognizes their marriage, you know, what they're saying is sort of the long arm of Ohio has reached into their relationship and stigmatized it in some way. And as a result, right, The Brief from Ohio, which is mostly about these non-recognition of out-of-state marriages, really is very powerful because it talks about people who are married, yet this other state has taken steps to make sure that their marriage doesn't count.
And there's another couple, April DeBeer and Jane Rouse. They're both nurses in Michigan. They are raising three foster children, I think two of whom have some disability.
Well, they've adopted them now.
They've adopted them, yeah. But because their marriage, I guess, isn't recognized, Jeffrey, is that they don't have the same marriage rights and parental rights as heterosexual couples.
This may well weigh heavily with some of the justices. In the oral argument about the Windsor case, Justice Kennedy was struck by the fact, he said, gay couples can adopt. This will be an injury to lots of kids if they're denied full benefits. And it was significant that the court refused to stay the state court decisions allowing marriages to go forward earlier this year. The fact that in practice 37 states allow it, that there are all these marriages are on the books, may make it harder for some, even of the conservative justices, to try to undo and fail to give full recognition for these marriages.
Yeah, I mean, I think what would have to happen is in Pennsylvania, for example, right here, we have a state law that bars same-sex marriages. In the Whitewood case, a federal district court throws that law out. The governor decides not to appeal. Well, what happens if the Supreme Court now says that laws like this are okay? Does this law get reanimated? It would depend on how the opinion was written, what the legislature wanted to do subsequently. There are a lot of moving parts there. But a lot of people feel that the court, in waiting so long to take one of these cases and allowing all of these circuit court opinions to stand that permitted same-sex couples to marry and threw out many states' laws, really has sort of tipped its hand. And that to go back now and unravel all of these marriages would be difficult. It has happened, right? In Prop 8 in California, in 2008, California Supreme Court says that same-sex couples have a constitutional right to marry. Prop 8 passes. That right is taken away. Now you have all these couples in limbo. The state Supreme Court decided that those marriages were still valid, but that was not a foregone conclusion. And it wasn't until the Prop 8 case got decided by the Supreme Court that that problem went away. It creates a lot of complexity.
Indeed. Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking, actually, as the U.S. Supreme Court is hearing oral arguments today, a case that will be known forever as Obergefell v. Hodges. And it's a long-awaited case about the rights of same-sex couples to marry or, conversely, for states to ban same-sex marriage. Talking with John Culhane, professor of law, also co-director of the Family Health Law and Policy Institute, and that's at Widener Law, Delaware. Also with us is Jeffrey Rosen, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center here in Philadelphia. To join our conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about what the U.S. Supreme Court is hearing today, this morning, hearing arguments about whether states can allow same-sex couples to marry and whether states must recognize same-sex marriages performed in other states. And again, our guests are Jeffrey Rosen and John Culhane. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Jeffrey, there's always that question about the kinds of questions that the justices are going to be asking, and there are a whole bunch of lawyers that are going to be in the court today. What is the tone? How many interruptions? I mean, what should people be, not that we can hear it in real time and we probably won't be able to see it ever, but what should we be listening for?
Well, on the one hand, people say you can't tell which way a case is going from oral argument. On the other hand, they say the opposite, that if you count up the number of questions that a side receives, the side that receives more questions is more likely to lose, because that suggests a kind of skepticism from the justices. Lots of eyes, obviously, on Chief Justice Roberts. He did not tip his hand in the oral argument about the Affordable Care Act case, where he was uncharacteristically sphinx-like in his silence. He asked just one pointed question. and people will be trying to figure out whether he might be looking for a narrower ground for possibly arguing in favor of same-sex marriage, possibly saying that once you've granted the right, you can't take it away, or possibly saying that states can't fail to recognize marriages in other states. On the other hand, it's possible, given Chief Justice Roberts' opinions in the Windsor case where he said he's not eager to tar with animus the voters of a state, that he might possibly join dissenters. The conventional wisdom is that there are at least five votes for striking down these bans.
Kennedy Justice being that
Kennedy,
middle one?
You know, he's written all of the major decisions about gay rights, and there's no reason to feel that he wouldn't write one here. The big question, though, is will the opinion be broad or narrow? So if it were a broad decision, and if Justice Kennedy, joined by the liberal justices, says either marriage is a fundamental right or restrictions on marriage basically infringe the dignitary rights of gays and lesbians, that broad ruling could be invoked by people to say you cannot get exemptions from anti-discrimination laws if you're a religious organization, that basically if discrimination against gays and lesbians is just as bad as discriminations against African Americans, then just as Bob Jones College isn't allowed not to admit African Americans, so gays and lesbians have to have full rights in the workplace. On the other hand, if Justice Kennedy and the liberals come up with a narrower decision saying these particular referenda were infected by animus, but we're not going to say that discrimination against gays and lesbians is just as bad as that against African Americans. It's called strict or heightened scrutiny, to use the jargon. That would allow the argument that religious exemption should continue to exist. So the so although the ultimate outcome of the decision people think is relatively forward.
Certain?
And not – it would be really irresponsible.
Okay,
and silly.
Anyone
in any constitutional case says the answer is certain, reach for your wallet.
I mean,
there are good arguments on both sides. Remember what happened in healthcare too. There are so many moving parts here. You have a chief justice who's a masterful strategist, is deeply conscious of his legacy, and might come up with some unexpected combination of votes or solutions that no one can predict right now. But I think it's fair to say there seem to be five votes on behalf of some ruling on behalf of same-sex marriage, but how broad or narrow that will be is going to be incredibly important.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
So just two points. One is that if I were the one arguing to the court, and if I were representing the states, knowing I needed Justice Kennedy's vote, which I think is going to be very difficult to get, he did say something during one of the oral arguments a couple of years ago in the Proposition 8 case, where he talked about, on the one hand, that fencing same-sex couples out from marriage demeaned the couples and humiliated their children. He actually said that. But he also said, but we should be concerned here about we've got, you know, millennia of defining marriage in a certain way. And he talked about, you know, jumping off a cliff into a place that sort of no one knows what will happen. And if you look at the state's briefs, and particularly some of the amicus briefs in this case that I've really spent, you know, way too much time reading, you will see that what they're trying to do is to project out 20, 30 years and looking at what might happen to marriage if it were defined in what they're calling this kind of genderless way where any two consenting adults can marry unless there are other, you know, restrictions. And the concern is that it would lead to the dissolution of marriage. It could lead to more abortions, I've read. Someone was predicting as many as 900,000 more abortions in the next 30 years. But this is all speculation. But what they're trying to do, I think, my guess is to move Justice Kennedy just that bit that they think they need to. I don't think it's going to work, but I think that's a possibility. The other thing I just wanted to say real quickly is the way the court has framed the questions, which is in this kind of anodyne sort of neutral way, right? Is the state required, you know, to issue marriage licenses to two people of the same sex? Is the state required to recognize out-of-state marriages by two people of the same sex? They're really staying away from, you know, levels of scrutiny and fundamental rights and giving themselves kind of running room to create a narrower basis for decision. And my understanding was, I'm not too much into what the court does behind the scenes, but that they really struggle to come up with the framing of those questions, which could be telling all by itself.
Well, that's interesting. I do want to quote something from all of a sudden I lost his name, Sutton. So this was the case that sort of has made its way to the Supreme Court. And Jeffrey, this is something that you wrote in, it looks like, the New Republic, something that has been defined as responsible procreation, which we will talk about. But let me just quote from Judge Sutton. He says, the biological reality that couples of the same sex do not have children in the same way as couples of opposite sexes, and that couples of the same sex do not run the risk of unintended children. I guess the argument is that there's one way to have children in this country in 2015?
You know, this is a tricky argument, and it's surprisingly more important than you'd think. So basically, you've got to come up with a defense of these laws that doesn't involve traditional morality or preserving tradition. And the answer is responsible procreation. And here I'm going to try to reconstruct it as neutrally as I can. And this is the way it goes.
Okay.
Straight people can have kids without IVF or without any AIDS.
Or adoption.
Right. Gay people cannot. Straight people really need discipline because guys are really brutish and irresponsible and tend to impregnate women and run. Gay people, by contrast, are very responsible because they have to think before they procreate and either adopt or use IVF. Therefore, here's the tricky part. If you allow gay marriage, that might devalue marriage for straight people, make those brutish guys even more irresponsible and make them impregnate and run more quickly and therefore lead to more irresponsible procreation. Gay people don't need the prestige of marriage because they're already incredibly responsible. Now, if you think that was
a little convoluted argument I've ever heard.
Well, you know what? When the lawyer tried it, at the oral argument, I think it was in the Prop 8 case, Justice Kagan basically said that's not a serious argument, right? Because that can't be the real reason that these laws were passed. And then in the Windsor case, she said, well, that's a fake reason because look at what Congress actually said. They said, we want to express moral disapproval of homosexuality. And there was a gasp in the courtroom. Basically, she was smoking out the idea this convoluted fake reason is a smokescreen. Mm-hmm. The real reason is the desire to preserve traditional morality. But the fact that that's all that is on the books just shows how few permissible reasons there are once you rule out of bounds moral disapproval and preserving tradition.
And picking up on this, and actually, John, going back to you, you gave the conservative or the argument coming from the states about why these bans should remain. But when you look at studies from the American Psychological Association, organizations of doctors and children's health, I mean, none of that is true. That gay couples can't raise children.
Right. So there are two arguments here that are related but I think important to keep separate. So the first is the one you've articulated, which is basically that kids do best when they're raised by a mother and a father. And those studies really compared intact marriages to single parents, remarried, you know, step families and children of divorce. The studies that have compared you know, traditional couples to same-sex couples in intact relationships have found that there's really no advantage to the kids who are being raised by a mother and a father, which is interesting because the same-sex couples haven't had the benefit of marriage to keep them together sort of historically, right? So and in fact, one of the interesting things I found in one of the amicus briefs is the attempt now is to say that the data aren't clear enough, that the studies are methodologically flawed. They're not really sort of debating it on the merits. What they're trying to say is it's this idea about waiting because we need more studies. They're not really saying that the studies don't show this, but that they should ignore the studies is basically what they're saying. That's the first argument. The second argument is the one that Jeff just articulated, and that is a little bit different. There's this great line in a Seventh Circuit opinion by Judge Posner where he says, opposite sex couples can have unwanted children by the carload, he says, and they get to marry, whereas same sex couples are responsible and they can't marry. Go figure is what he says at the end of that quote. It's typical of Judge Posner, who's a bit of a, you know, wag in terms of the court. But I do think that those are the kinds of arguments that you're going to hear about responsible procreation and the long-term damage to marriage from their perspective if same-sex couples are allowed to marry.
And that's John Culhane from Widener Law, Delaware. Also with us, Jeffrey Rosen of the National Constitution Center. And we are talking about some of the arguments that will be heard or are being heard in the U.S. Supreme Court today, Obergefell v. Hodges. And it raises a whole host of questions that we have been talking about, things like states' rights and marriage and due process and equality under the law. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. And we'll be opening up the phones in just a couple of minutes. An email from Rich. He says, marriage is instituted by God, not a right by man. God ordained marriage between one man and one woman. Why does the Supreme Court not see this? The entire creation is laughing at the stupidity of leaders who try to placate the rule of God by their wisdom. This is a serious question, which is for people that truly believe that, as Rich clearly does. How does in this country with our legal system, how does the courts acknowledge that?
It's a very serious argument. For much of our history, that would have been a legitimate argument because states were given broad discretion to regulate health, safety, and morals. And there are a whole bunch of Supreme Court decisions from as late as the 1920s saying that basically God ordained woman's place to be in the home and therefore laws protecting them, you know, were permissible and that sort of thing. But the law changed very significantly in the Lawrence case from 2003, where Justice Kennedy said that moral disapproval of a particular practice is not a legitimate basis for banning it. And he essentially adopted John Stuart Mill's harm principle and said that unless a particular practice harms someone else, the state cannot ban it because of moral disapproval. Justice Scalia was apoplectic about this. He said, this means the end of all morals legislation. He said it'll mean the end of laws forbidding not only requiring, you know, forbidding same-sex marriage, but also adultery, prostitution, fornication, even, forgive me, but this is in the opinion, he said masturbation.
That's right.
No one knew that this was illegal in some states, but apparently
it was.
But this was a very serious exchange. And the question of whether you can have laws based on moral disapproval has come up in – there was a case – the circuits were split about whether you could ban sex toys, for example. And the thought is some people disapproved of that morally, but if it didn't cause harm to others, you couldn't. So I think the question gets at a very profound frustration that I can respect the fact that religiously observant people have. It comes up very powerfully in a brief filed by a group of religious organizations. They're saying if you're going to just tar our deepest and most heartfelt beliefs as bigotry, you're reading us out of the American conversation. And I think it all comes down to this big important move Justice Kennedy made when he said moral disapproval is not a legitimate basis for legislation.
And just to make sure our listeners go, this is when the Supreme Court ruled it was a landmark case, in fact, involving a sodomy law in Texas, voting 6-3. This was Lawrence v. Texas, a case affirming the right of gay couples to have consensual sex.
That's right. And in that case, the court threw out a decision that it had reached in 1986. So this is unusual for the Supreme Court to overrule itself just in the space of 17 years. And basically recognizing that part of the way people define themselves is through their most intimate conduct. And there are different ways of reading Lawrence. It's certainly written in a broad way. And Justice Scalia, because he is fond of sort of reading opinions he doesn't agree with, as kind of Jeremiads, right?
Yes.
And basically saying, you know, this is the end of morals legislation. What it probably is the end of morals legislation as it applies to conduct that's really central to people's self-definition, the way they experience life in the world. And in fact, the sex toys cases out of the South, my recollection is that they ended up going the other way because the courts found that they were kind of that the right to have a sex toy is more kind of instrumental and not so fundamental to your definition of self. So it, I know this is probably too much information for your listeners.
No, it's actually quite fascinating.
Jeff, you started it.
So
Justice Scalia started it. It wasn't my fault.
That's right. But you know, I think it's a concern that people do have, and you see a lot of writing by conservative legal scholars and just scholars in general or pundits saying this makes us bigots in the public square if you sort of fence out our beliefs. But the idea is you're not sort of fencing them out. No church is required to solemnize a same-sex union, you can still have your beliefs. But the question is sort of what is the permissible limitation of state power?
Well, and just going back, and I actually have Scalia's, what he said in my hands here, state laws against bigamy, same-sex marriage, adult incest, prostitution, masturbation, adultery, fornication, bestiality, and obscenity. Every single one of these laws is called into question by today's decision. This was the Lawrence case. And you're saying, Jeffrey, this was really a watershed moment for the court and also for our understanding about, I guess, what, morality in the laws?
Yes. And I think Justice Scalia was correct about that. It was a Jeremiah. That's a good word. But he predicted both that the decision would lead to recognition of same-sex marriage, but that it would be very hard to justify laws purely based on religious objection. Now, this is a really important question in American life. There was a point at which some scholars, such as Lawrence Tribe, said you can't have a law that's based purely on religious objection because that violates the Establishment Clause, which prohibits establishments of religion. Tribe backed away from that conclusion because he came to realize that so many of our laws are based on religious and moral objections from laws, starting with laws about murder. So basically, to say the fact that a religion believes that something is immoral is not a legitimate basis for law could call a lot of laws into question, unless there's some independent grounds for banning the practice. So for murder, obviously, it's protection against violence. Or for incest, you can say it's to protect the kids. But that's a big change. And Justice Scalia is correct that for much of American history, an opposite rule had prevailed and states had much more leeway just to express their moral disapproval. Of course, and the slippery slopes that lawyers love to play with are coming true. The next Justice Scalia has also said this will mean the end of laws restricting polygamy. And my GW colleague Jonathan Turley has filed a bunch of lawsuits arguing that, in fact, polygamous marriages should be allowed because the objection to them is basically religious and moral. And that's, again, a good argument. So I think this is a very, very important debate. And it may be why the Supreme Court in this case wants to shy away from a really broad libertarian opinion and try to decide it on slightly narrower grounds.
Let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about we ended up talking about sex toys.
Sorry about that.
The U.S. Supreme Court. But it's all connected, folks. And we are talking with John Culhane, co-director of the Family Health Law and Policy Institute at Widener Law, Delaware. Also with us, Jeffrey Rosen, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center. And we are talking actually about a very important case being argued today before the U.S. Supreme Court, Obergefell v. Hodges. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Mosco. And just a recap here, the U.S. Supreme Court is hearing oral arguments today, this morning, in cases involving bans on same-sex marriage in four states. At issue are the rights of gay and lesbian couples to marry and states to make their own laws. Today, same-sex couples are free to marry in 36 states and the District of Columbia. The justices have allotted 2.5 hours for the lawyers to make their respective cases. This is going to be a close watched decision with a number of important constitutional issues at stake. And that's what we're talking about with our guests, John Culhane and Jeffrey Rosen. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. And again, I've got a bunch of emails here I need to read as well. Radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. In fact, a tweet from Katie says, does separation of church and state have any significance in this decision? Jeffrey, can I toss that back to you?
It's a great question. I think the bottom line is no, only because although one justice, John Paul Stevens, also flirted with the idea that laws based on morality would violate the separation of church and state, the court has never held that, and the majority opinion has backed away from that. Instead, they've, as we've been discussing, said moral disapproval is not permissible regardless of the religious motivation.
Josh? Just real quickly, I mean, one of the reasons I think religion gets so caught up with this is that in the United States, and this is not true in many other countries, we expressly involve religious organizations, right? The clergy in the solemnization of marriage. So they are, you know, when they say by the power vested in me by the state, well, the power really is vested in them by the state. And so there are some who have argued that the state really should just be issuing marriage licenses, and either we don't need solemnization as a separate thing, or if we do, that could be done in a solely public way where I should, yeah, public way as well, and not by sort of deputizing, you know, rabbis, priests, imams to, you know, to do this.
How about the RFRA laws that are now, you know, bubbling up in a number of states and these discussions about, you know, baking cakes for gay weddings or delivering pizzas to gay weddings?
So this is really the next generation of challenges about the clash between religion and gay rights. And those laws will be affected by today's decision. So if the court holds that sexual orientation is just as bad as racial discrimination, then attempts to claim religious exemptions under those state RFRA laws will be much harder to support. Basically, it'll be like race discrimination, and you won't be able to say, even if you're a gay, if you're a religious wedding photographer, you won't be able to refuse to photograph the gay wedding. If, by contrast, the court rules for gay marriage on narrower grounds, then the wedding photographer might be able to say, I'm a sole proprietorship. The court held in the Hobby Lobby case that corporations that are closely held have religious freedom rights, and it's a burden on my religious expression to force me to photograph the wedding. We had there was an amazing exchange at the National Constitution Center recently on Freedom Day, where the head of the ACLU and the head of the Cato Institute, a libertarian organization, were disagreeing about this. And the ACLU head, Anthony Romero, who's gay, said, you are personally insulting my rights. This is demeaning to me to be able to claim religious exemptions from these laws. And the head of Cato said people should basically be able to make whatever business arrangements they choose. It was an electric clash. And I think there's no when religious conservatives are looking at this ruling today, they're going to be very closely watching the breadth of this because they are centrally concerned about whether or not these religious exemptions are going to be permissible going forward.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
That's very well said. I guess I would just add that there's been this piece of the dialogue, which I think is interesting, which is to separate out the kinds of services that we associate with same-sex weddings, like talking about baking a cake. And who would ever deliver a pizza to a gay wedding? I don't know. That's another that's another whole problem.
Right, that's a whole other show,
That's a whole
actually.
Other show. But it's a much broader question than that. And there have been some legal scholars, whom I respect, actually, who have suggested sort of carving out exemptions from laws for things related to a wedding, to say that you have to serve gay people. If they walk into your store to buy a mug, you have to sell it to them. But if they're going in to do something connected with a wedding, you should be able to sort of invoke some kind of exemption. I don't think that's a defensible line to draw. I think it's much too complicated. And so really it gets to the broader question of should people be able to, you know, discriminate in the private workplace, whether it's public accommodations, whether it's employers, against people because of their sexual orientation. And as you know, in Pennsylvania, now same-sex couples can marry on Saturday and then get fired, not in Philadelphia because we have the protection here, but in many parts of the state could be fired from their jobs on Monday. So I do think that this ruling, if it comes out the way we expect it to, is going to create kind of attention. And I think Jeff is exactly right that the breadth of the decision will go a long way toward understanding exactly how that accommodation is going to be made.
I want to quote something from Chief Justice Earl Warren. This goes back to the Loving case, back to the 1950s. He said, the freedom to marry has long been recognized as one of the vital personal rights essential to the orderly pursuit of happiness by free men. I mean, he's the worst man, but this was, you know, a generation or two ago. I mean, if we're talking about precedent or even tradition, what role does that play?
So this is a great question, and it's very important whether the court will follow that broad ruling in Loving, which said that marriage is a fundamental right rooted in the Due Process Clause. Because if it does, that would have huge implications for all the anti-discrimination laws we're talking about and essentially would make it impermissible to treat gay people differently across a whole range of issues. But there was another strain in that Loving opinion, and that had to do not with liberty but with equality. And if the court in this case focuses more on the Equal Protection Clause and says that it's a form of anti-gay animus to pass these state referenda, but marriage is not a fundamental right that has to be extended to everyone on equal terms, then it would be easier to resist the argument for polygamists. It would be easier to maintain restrictions on, bigamy and other, siblings marrying and so forth. And essentially, the ruling would be much narrower. So the advocates in this case, as good advocates must, are doing the kitchen sink. They're saying first it's broadly a fundamental right under the Liberty Clause. It's also a form of anti-gay-animus under equal protection. But the court can pick and choose among those, and there's a lot hanging on how much Loving actually ends up defining this precedent.
Oh, that's interesting. In due process, as I understand it, you can't take away someone's right to life, liberty, or property without good cause, right?
Well, that really goes more to the idea of procedural due process. But there's this idea of substantive due process, which is no matter what processes you use, if it's someone's fundamental liberty, the state really needs a compelling reason, right, to deprive you of that. And so there's this question about whether it's marriage that's the fundamental right that would include the right to marry someone you're actually attracted to, right? Or whether it's marriage as historically understood as the union of a man and a woman. So that could be sort of part of the tension here. If you look at the Windsor case, though, that's the Defense of Marriage Act case again, right, from 2013. The case is really slippery in the sense that it's very difficult to tell from Justice Kennedy's majority opinion whether he's talking about due process or equal protection. And I've argued in a book chapter that I just wrote that really it's kind of this alloy or this fusion of the ideas of equal protection and due process. I call it ball of constitutional fusion. but the idea is that he really is sort of articulating this idea of dignity, which kind of is fusing these two ideas. And that's where I think you might see the court go very quickly. It's possible Justice Roberts, one reason for him to be in the majority is that he could take the case. He gets to assign the cases and write the decision himself if he wants to write something narrower than what Justice Kennedy would write. So there's another piece.
Interesting. Let me get Debbie from, looks like, Aston, PA to join us. Debbie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I would just like to say that I feel that religion should be taken out of this decision because, to me, marriage really is a legal thing. And so it's like, you know, civil and, you know, the state and the government, you know, when you get married, you have legal advantages. And to me, it should be a legal decision. Like, I don't really believe myself to be any religion. I'm not even sure I believe in God at times. So for, you know,
sure,
a lot of people, they just get married in civil ceremonies and there isn't even a religious ceremony. Like, people that want to get, you know, have a religious ceremony, that's all well and good. But this decision really should be, you know, not, religion shouldn't be involved.
Like, I hear you.
This, like, separation of state and church.
I hear you, Debbie. Thanks for calling in. Let me toss that to you, Jeffrey Rosen.
It's a great point. My sense is lots of people agree with Debbie, and Europe has a situation like this where main marriage is civil and you can choose to have a religious ceremony if you like. That division would solve a lot of the constitutional problems that we're talking about, and all this question of moral disapproval by religion would go away. But for better or worse, that's not the U.S. tradition. Oh. Our marriage laws have developed in a different way where marriages are solemnized by religion and the court
They don't have to be.
They have to be solemnized by someone. They have to be solemnized. They could be justice of the peace, but they must be solemnized.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And
right.
Typically it's religious, that religious person.
And we don't have the good solution that Debbie suggests, which is two separate tracks where first you have a state ceremony and then there's the possibility of a religious ceremony.
Just very quickly, one of the things that sort of been lost is in 2003 when the Supreme Court of Massachusetts became the first state Supreme Court to require the issuance of marriage licenses to same-sex couples. When that court talked about marriage, almost in every case, they used the modifier civil before the word marriage. So they really went out of their way to detach the idea of marriage from its kind of religious association. And that was a smart and a deliberate move to try to take some of the heat out of what they were doing. By the way, not successfully. But they tried.
They tried. A tweet from Tom. Actually, this is to you, John. Is it possible we could get a unanimous opinion like in Brown? Do you think that's...
No. That's all I have to say.
No for you, Jeffrey?
Agreed.
Agreed. Okay. An email from Beverly. Those who want to control people based on their own personal religious beliefs need to remember there was a time in this country when slavery was supported based upon what people quoted from the Bible. I mean, when you mix, I guess, politics and religion, and the law, there's a rich history there.
There is a rich history. It also has to be said that some of the most powerful arguments against slavery were also rooted in religion, and the abolitionists were fired with their conviction that slavery violated the natural rights of liberty and equality. So there are certainly American politics and constitutional conversations are suffused with religion. It's so hard to separate them, and that's why attempts to do so are so so difficult.
Yeah, and the civil rights movement. I mean, that, you know, what was that if not you know, sort of religiously fired up on the ones on both sides, right? So you know, you had conservatives arguing that this defied the will of God to have the races mixing. You even saw that in the Loving Against Virginia case by a state court judge, right? That God created the races different and put them on different continents. And so you have it on both sides. And I think that's just an inescapable fact of American life. That's not going to change because of this context.
Let me see what Steve from Reading has to say. Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes, I'm a pastor of a church in Reading, Pennsylvania, and have been a strong supporter of same-sex marriage. I've done a couple of them towards the end of 2014 in my church when it became legal. But I want to speak to the question of clergy, especially in churches, who think that they will be forced to do these weddings. I don't have to do another wedding my whole life if I don't want to. You know, I'm the one who chooses based on our church's standards who gets married. So that's never going to be an issue.
Well, I think that's right.
That's an interesting point, Steve. Yeah, go ahead.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, if there's anything that's clear about sort of what the reach of these decisions would be or this decision would be, it's that no church official would be forced to solemnize a union that went against his or her own religious beliefs. I think that piece of it has been pretty clear. And
you agree with
that,
Jeffrey?
I do. And even the Hobby Lobby decision made clear that already in federal law there are exemptions for religious organizations and hospitals from laws of general applicability, and therefore those would remain on the books. And really we're talking about non-religious organizations and their obligation to obey anti-discrimination laws. Pastors would absolutely have their conscience rights protected. That's a really important point.
Steve, thanks for the call to Radio Times. An email from Chuck, he says, doesn't the whole procreation argument fall apart considering that infertile and elderly heterosexual couples are permitted to marry? I mean, that is the argument, right, Jeffrey?
Justice Kagan made this so wittily at the recent Prop 8 oral argument, and she basically said, there aren't a lot of octogenarian parents. How could procreation possibly be the real reason?
Yeah, and in fact, in the Seventh Circuit case, Judge Posner pointed to one of the state laws that allowed first cousins to marry, but only if they were over a certain age. And the whole idea was they could only marry if they couldn't procreate. So I think that really is a powerful point to suggest that while there is this association with marriage and procreation, it's not a perfect fit and that there are other things that marriage is about. And when you talk about the first cousins of that age, it really is about companionship and commitment and those kinds of things. So I think that actually, even though it's a really sort of idiosyncratic example, is a very good one.
We're almost out of time here. But Jeffrey, is this sort of bottom line? Are we meaning the country, trying to redefine what marriage is in this century and beyond, maybe?
We've been doing that over the past decade, and there's been just this remarkable sea change in public opinion, so that when I started teaching constitutional law in the 90s, conventional wisdom was that gay marriage was not a constitutional right. Now it's the opposite, and that's because people marched in the streets. That's because there were legislative moves and moves in Congress and judicial decisions. And this decision, if it comes to codify a right of marriage equality, will not be a bolt from the blue that's invented by the Supreme Court. It'll do what Justice Ginsburg has argued courts should do, which is codify social change after it's already occurred.
And we've been defining marriage, you know, and redefining it forever, right? In terms of the role of women, in terms of fault versus no fault. So marriage is constantly undergoing redefinition, and this will be another advance from my perspective.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you so much for joining us today in Radio Times and giving us a constitutional lesson on this very important case being argued before the U.S. Supreme Court. John Culhane from Widener Law, Delaware. Jeffrey Rosen of the National Constitution Center. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and also how to listen on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moss. Gascoigne. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.